So we'll begin this evening Q&A. Wow. That's a real basketful. Okay. I have to admit that I have very little faith in the possibility of being enlightened in this lifetime. Perhaps stream entry. Is stream entry a realistic possibility for many of us if leading householder lives? It's not only a realistic possibility, it's probably the best possibility or best realistic possibility. On a certain level, whether one is a monastic or a layperson, there's probably a lot more efficacy in having setting a goal for oneself towards stream entry. Because sometimes if you set something incredibly refined as an object of one's aspirations, then it's hard to, sometimes harder to realize. Whereas stream entry is actually, you can get your hands on it a bit more easily and get a sense of, oh yeah, right, yeah. Oh. And not only is it desirable, it's doable, eminently doable. And if one looks at the suttas, when the Buddha gives the most common criteria for a person who is a stream enterer, is, say, one with unshakable confidence in the Buddha, unshakable confidence in the Dhamma, unshakable confidence in the Sangha, and being established in the five precepts, and in virtue. So that's not outside of one's capability at all. And it's also, in terms of the effect that it has, it sets one on an inexorable trajectory towards full realization. So that it's absolutely worth really considering. There's a whole chapter on it in the book The Island. Well, actually, maybe even a couple chapters, because it is something that, say, in our culture, we tend to set our desires on the most subtle, the most refined, the way our mind goes, and then sometimes it can be discouraging. So to take something like stream entry and really break it down and get a feel for it is really, really an important part of encouraging oneself in the practice and recognizing that's really, really something that is possible. There's a question, is it permissible to take notes during your talks? Yeah, I don't mind. Sometimes it's helpful for being able to keep awake. I remember one time seeing that the Crown Princess of Thailand, she'd go to religious ceremonies and there'd be a Dhamma talk and she'd be there taking notes. And I remember making the comment to one of the people who are familiar with the palace and said, wow, that's really impressive. She's taking notes. And he says, she does that so she can keep awake. Which is really skillful. There. But it is, if you find it useful, it's okay, as long as it doesn't sort of be a distraction for others. Can you speak about the balance between implementing an antidote to a hindrance and practicing patience? I'm having a lot of aversion, and as I try to use both of these practices, I'm finding myself full of doubt and confusion. There's just one more hindrance to the list. It's multiple hindrance attack. I think in the end you just have to go with what actually works and what is helpful, what helps to create a sense of space around a particular hindrance, because and it doesn't really matter what it is, in order for it to dissipate, it has to be seen clearly. And then by being able to see that clearly, then one can, you have to experiment. You know, so much of the practice is being willing to experiment, willing to try something out, willing to kind of get your hands dirty in the practice, rather than, you know, kind of stepping back and hoping it's all going to go away. So that if you try a particular antidote and say, oh wow, that's not really working, and say, oh wow, because there's so many different tools and techniques that the Buddha gave, that we have that opportunity for experimenting and trying and see, well, what actually works for ourselves. And then that aspect of patience is kind of a perspective or a stance that one can rely on in order to not be swept up in the immediate emotion of the particular hindrance. That saying, that being able to just be present with the hindrance. Because one of the things with, say, the function of patience as well is not so much just patiently waiting for it to go away, but being present so that one can really see it more clearly and then see how that particular suffering or discontent or dissatisfaction is actually arising. When it's seen more clearly, then you've got the opportunity to getting a handle on that and then seeing, intuiting what does one want to experiment with and try, what one thinks is actually going to work. Next question: is the concept of anatta or no self a suitable object of meditation? Absolutely. It's an extremely important object of meditation in the sense that it's one of the distinguishing characteristics of the Buddha's teachings, or one of the unique aspects of the Buddha's teachings. But it's also helpful to approach it skillfully, because one can just sort of run oneself in circles conceptualizing the whole aspect of not self or of no self and end up confused. So over the next days I'll probably address this aspect of not self, the anatta aspect, so that it can be maybe breathe some life into it. What's the difference between proliferation and directed thought? Well, proliferation is more random, more scattered, more generated by greed, hatred, or delusion, whereas directed thought, there's a quality of mindfulness. You're directing thought in a way that is, it's a tool that you're using, rather than proliferation is just the habits of mind are using thought just to keep spinning. So that directed thought is something that one is applying mindfulness and discernment with, so that it's actually has a beneficial goal, it has a beneficial purpose to it. Okay, what are the characteristics / attainments of the Eight Noble Beings? Where are they described? Certainly the description of the, say, stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arahant, come up in the discourses and scattered all through the suttas. So the distinction of path and fruit, I think, is more of a commentarial description. So something like the Visuddhimagga, a book, an ancient text, would give detailed descriptions of both of these, that characteristic. It might be a bit mind-numbing. It can be a bit dry. But the Buddha doesn't actually go into really extensive descriptions of the fruits of the practice. I mean, he gives a basic, kind of an outline, a basic foundation, and then that's sort of enough. The Buddha doesn't go into it that extensively. On retreat, is it skillful to try to memorize some of the chants? One of the functions of memorizing chants is that it help to focus attention, helps one to keep that focus of the mind on a task, so that that's a skillful means for developing mindfulness. One of the most common descriptions of what is translated as the word mindfulness is around memory, being able to call to mind things that one has heard and read and has memorized, so that it is a skillful thing to be doing. And certainly the majority of the chants are, they have inspiring themes. Either it's reflective devices, or they're recitations of the special qualities of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, so that they tend to bring up a devotional aspect, a faith quality, and that's really skillful. For monastics, probably the vast majority of the chants that we've memorized have usually been memorized on our walking meditation paths. Would that be fair?
That's the way I do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I think you're learning chants and you'll be on the walking meditation path and you'll be memorizing chants, or in Thailand, a walking alms round, you take your little piece of paper and learn a few more lines each day. And so that would be a way of channeling attention and energy, so that there's that continuity of applying the mind. So it can be really helpful, skillful for just that sustaining that application of mind. Sometimes I experience what one of my teachers has called a multiple hindrance attack. For me, this manifests as sloth and torpor and restlessness, feeling as if they're arising simultaneously. Sloth and torpor may be primary, I'm not sure. Any wise words, Ajahn? Well, maybe there's doubt in there as well. So if you're going to have a multiple hindrance attack, you might as well do the whole schmear. I think, in terms of, when hindrances arise, just that recognizing, well, what is primary and what does it feel like? And then we're starting to put attention and energy onto, it really doesn't matter which one. Sort of like, because whatever wholesome mental states are generated, whatever wholesome dhammas that arise, they'll undermine however the hindrances manifest. In the Pali, and this is where it's helpful to know a few sort of key words in the scriptural language. That's the kusala and akusala. Wholesome, unwholesome, skillful, unskillful. It doesn't really line up in the same sort of way as from a Western concept of sort of good and bad, because something like sloth and torpor or restlessness, I mean, it isn't as if it's really bad, but it is a hindrance. It is unskillful. The mind is not clear. The mind is not really settled. It's not able to really discern clearly. So that's where when akusala it's unwholesome, and it undermines a fundamental capability of the mind. But as soon as we generate kusala in any way, then that tends to snowball and affect the mind as a whole, so that the mind becomes more bright, energized, steady, clear, and that's just the nature of the wholesome kusala jitta, the mind of wholesomeness. So so in any way which we can be fostering that and supporting that, it will gain momentum within the mind, and the manifestation of the hindrances will dissipate or be undermined. Could you please say a little more about the fifth hindrance, doubt? Is it self-doubt or doubt of the Dhamma? Traditionally, when it's described, say in the ancient texts or from the Buddha himself describing it, or you know, say particularly in say like the commentarial texts that are you know, they're quite ancient, I think the focus is on the doubt about the Dhamma, and on a certain level, I think say the degree to which we experience self-doubt is a fairly somewhat modern phenomenon. And you know, we've evolved to the point where we can tie ourselves up in knots and of self-doubt. But certainly, I think that that aspect of doubt, however it's manifesting, like really paying attention to what does doubt actually feel like? What does it feel like in the body? And that feeling of uncertainty, feeling of wavering, that just really not sure which is right and which is wrong. And it's just that wavering, quaking, uncertain, moving, where one can't really quite decide or see clearly what is it. And to be able to, what's it feel like? What does the mind do? What's the body do? And rather than trying to define it too tightly or too in too refined a way, but recognizing, oh yeah, that's just doubt. In the Pali word, the scriptural word, is very descriptive. Even if you don't understand the language, it's kind of onomatopoeic, sort of the vicikicca. You can sort of, vicikicca. Vicikicca. It's really not being very clear at all. I keep getting overwhelmed by a variety of intense and unpleasant bodily sensations. I've been trying to keep my focus on more neutral places in the body, but I still find that keeping the concentration anywhere in the body amplifies the unpleasant feelings, and I can't settle into a place of ease. One of the things is if one is looking at the, say, something that is unpleasant, and if one is trying to concentrate in any way, it's going to amplify. You have to look and see that sense of having a kind of, yeah, aversion to the unpleasant feeling. Aversion or anxiety, worry, this is going to be like this. And so that to be able to separate out the aversion or anxiety or fear that one is experiencing to the experience within the body, because in the end the body is just a body, and we identify with, this is my body and it shouldn't be like doing this, and this is my body and I want it to be like that, and this sensation that I'm feeling is just going on and it shouldn't be like that. And you know, we get this whole sort of storylines going, because that's where the energy that we invest in it is where the suffering actually lies. And then in the end, as I say, yeah, a body is just a body. So that to be able to recognize how we layer our experience with either that aversion or worry, and then to be able to allow kind of just natural rhythms to be a source of something soothing. Because that you say like the breath can end up getting into a real tangled knot just about breathing, and if you weren't breathing, you'd be really, I mean, that's really problematic. Is the breath, is it long, is it short, is it smooth, is it rough, is it, and we can get tangled into the assessing and the the kind of commentary that's there. So that, and that's where sometimes it's helpful to just to shift attention in terms of where walking meditation, it gives you an opportunity to just drop a lot of the kind of commentary that's going on in the mind, sort of that tangled knot. Or, they say, like chanting. We're saying learning chanting. Or, it's like that's what that experimenting of, well, what is it that is actually interesting in a soothing way? What's taking up that theme of loving kindness? Say, oh, yeah, we can really develop a wholesome mental state, a skillful mental state around those themes of loving kindness, compassion. Because traditionally, the first person that one directs loving kindness and compassion towards is oneself. Okay, there's a question for everybody or within this. May I ask the whole Abhayagiri gang, what is your favorite meditation object? So, I've already stated my case, the mindfulness of the breathing.
Okay, I guess I'm next. Favorite meditation object. I have a couple of different ones that I go between depending on what's going on inside, depending on what the hindrance is or the state of mind. But generally speaking, I work with Anapanasati and spend a fair amount of time on contemplation of the parts of the body, the 32 parts of the body, and just general presence of the body. And to some extent, it's called Marnasati, contemplation of death, as frequent reflections. And then, almost on a daily basis too, pulling in some metta, kindness meditation, to sort of round everything out, make it all
nice package. Okay. Jordan.
I've been doing a lot of Bhutto with kind of in connection with the breath and sometimes the body.
Okay. Debbie?
I do Anapanasati, but it's by the sensations breathing from the chest area. That seems to be the most take my attention to that. And then I do a lot of work with feeling this body sensation, especially as I get older.
And what's the tussle?
I usually do awareness of sensations in the body when not directly tied to the breath, but that's part of the field of awareness. In conjunction with the sound of silence. So if the mind is really scattered, then I might recite the Buddha's name. I personally find Buddha is too short, there's something a bit longer. Yeah, and contemplation of impermanence.
Great. That's a good night. That's a really nice range for everybody to see. It's a very good example of, you have to experiment and try, and you've got all these tools that you can be working with. Question is it true that having images of a certain animal around will make you likely to be that animal in your next life?
Answer questions that people don't want to hear the answer to.
I don't know. I doubt it. Okay. The question is, do you ever work with the quote-unquote thin line between sleep and waking, dreaming and lucidity? It seems like a powerful or useful fulcrum. Yes. I haven't really been put that much effort into it in past years, but previous times I've done a lot of work with around that sleep and waking, dreaming and lucidity, really trying to keep that the mindfulness going through, whether one is, you know, say, fully awake or even when one is sleeping, resting, putting a lot of attention and trying to keep that continuity of clarity and attention throughout. And there's different ways that one can be doing that. You know, certainly with just establishing a very clear posture in one's when one goes to sleep. The Buddha actually prescribes that sense of lying on one's right hand side and establishing mindfulness, and then making a clear determination to try to sustain mindfulness through one's period of sleep. So I really worked with that a lot. It's a useful, you realize as you investigate it more and more, sometimes you see how sleep can be the, you know, it's just a wonderful opportunity for just annihilation for at least a period of time. And you say, oh, wow. And then you keep bringing mindfulness to that even. And you realize, oh, there's a brightness of mind that can carry through all the aspects of one's life. It says, can you give further instruction about how to explore, investigate with the breath? I won't do it now, but I think as we continue over these next days, then there'll be more, probably more instruction around that. Many teachings suggest that we not pursue states of jhana, quote, if they happen, great, if not, don't worry. But in a room full of about 60 devoted meditators, it seems unlikely that any of us are achieving this type of absorption. If we were, then the chiming of the bowl would be disrupting many people's jhanic states of meditation. Is jhana really quite rare? I actually mentioned it today because that... you know, the word jhana, Ajahn Chah would just stay away from using it because it tends to have a lot invested in it and a lot of assumptions about its powers and or its characteristics. And it's a word that is, say, more literally mean, and sometimes it's translated as absorption. So that when the mind is really absorbing into an object, and of course the object could be the breath, it could be an object of reflection, and there's varying degrees of how settled and clear. So that's why Ajahn Chah would emphasize more the aspect of settled, steady, composed. And this is absolutely desirable. I mean, it's necessary to be cultivating these qualities of composure and clarity and settled. And and then to whatever degree one can, then one should be putting forth effort to try to realize, yeah, more refined and more still states of mind. Whatever kind of level it's called in the books, who knows what it is. But I think it's important to be attending to the mind in a way that allows it to settle, allows it to become more clear. And that's it's a gift to oneself. It becomes problematic when you're trying to measure yourself too much and lining it up according to what somebody else says is what this is or that is, and it ends up getting confusing. But when you, you know, when you experience a state of well-being and clarity, yeah, you know that, and you know what it feels like. Can you please speak about how one practices on the third path and what happens leading up to third path attainment? And then I also want to ask how long it takes, but I doubt there's an answer. The distinguishing characteristic of the third path is the complete relinquishing of sense desire and ill will. There's no draw to sensuality, no movement towards aversion, ill will, irritation. Now, that's very refined. That's the being able to completely relinquish those stains within the mind that where there's still that draw to sensual desire, sensuality, sense gratification, or irritation, ill will. So that actually relies on strong concentration. It also goes both ways in the sense that when the mind is not pulled out to sense desire or ill will, the mind really concentrates. So that's one of the characteristics of an anagami, or one who is realized that third path attainment, is their meditations will be quite solid and steady. Okay, please, can you share some ways to deal with pride when the ego influences feelings negatively? Well, I think one of the things is, in terms of pride, as is a difference in how the Buddha perceives it and how we tend to use that word. Because that sense of ego, self, the I making and the mind making are both, from the Buddha's perspective, any place where that sense of I establishes itself and compares itself to somebody else it's a source of suffering, it's a source of dukkha. And the comparison towards others in the sense of I'm inferior to others is just as much suffering as, well, I'm superior, or that I'm equal. Taking any kind of a position, inferior, equality, superior, in any way, shape, or form, is just complicating what doesn't need to be complicated. It's adding something that doesn't need to be there. And we do it all the time. And, of course, we suffer all the time as well. So so it's really being able to tune into and recognize the quality of complication, unnecessary complication. In the Pali language, I think it's really hits the nail on the head in the sense that how the word that the Buddha uses, the I making and the mind making. It's not as if the I and the mind have an independent existence. You make it, you bring it into being. The me in there creating that I. We're making it all the time, and we reap the fruits of that. Seeing the suffering, seeing the agitation that comes from that position that we take and that comparing to others. Could you please talk about the process of cutting the chain of dependent origination? With a more mature practice, can one cut the chain earlier among the different links? How does this take place experientially? It doesn't really matter, because the chain of dependent origination is actually not a linear chain. It's a circle, it's a cycle. And at any point where it is, where there's relinquishment, letting go, seeing clearly, then the whole thing collapses. It's like a house of cards, to where you just pull one card out and the whole thing tumbles down. So it's like, in terms of practice, then it's starting to look at different points that actually make sense to one, that where one can get a feel for, oh yeah, that there's that link between feeling and desire. Now that's really tangible, where there's a pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling, and there's some kind of desire that arises out of that. Experientially, one can feel, all right, that's kind of tangible, right? And I can work with that. And being able to see that more clearly and then pull away from that habitual pattern of getting hooked into the desire. And it could be any of the links. It really doesn't matter. But it's what is important is recognizing there is this causal process. And then as soon as one sees that more clearly, then any of those causal links can be a place where one can pull the pin on it. Or it's like the image that Ajahn Chah used one time of, he said, you know, it's sort of like having a balloon. And, you know, there's this balloon is all full and, you know, you think it's big, but as soon as you just put a little pinprick in it, it's empty. You know? So that's what it's like. Has anyone ever attained enlightenment while walking meditating? What are the pros and cons of walking meditation? Let's see. Try and go through my memory bank and see if I remember any stories of somebody attaining enlightenment while walking meditation. Certainly the Buddha praises walking meditation. The forest tradition in general places a large importance on walking meditation. You see it at Abhayagiri. Every dwelling place has a really well-established walking meditation path so that one can develop the walking meditation. It's a nice balance in the meditation to be able to be doing some walking and then alternating with sitting. Ajahn Chah used to say that if you see in a monastery the walking paths are neglected, then you can see that the practice of the monastics in that monastery is not very diligent. And remember in one time, sort of, I went walking around the monastery and saw these unswept walking paths, didn't see any footprints of any monks, just a bunch of dog prints on your mind. giving the monks a bad time. One of the things that Ajahn Chah used to say in terms of a benefit of walking meditation was that there's a natural tendency in walking meditation to be reflecting on things, so that in the sitting meditation you develop a stillness. And there's a stillness, there's a quiet within the mind that is very steady and solid. And then when one does the walking meditation, it's quite natural that the mind can reflect and investigate on the teachings or on the practice. And so with that alternating with sitting and walking, then you have this continuity of stillness and investigation. Which is very important for practice. How does one develop compassion such that one harbors no ill will even when wild bandits dismember you with a double-handed saw? So that's in one of the suttas. And the Buddha actually says, you know, if bandits dismember you with a two-handled saw and thoughts of ill will arise in your mind, then you've not been practicing the teachings properly. And, oh man, that bar is really high. In the end, you know, in terms of compassion and that compassion, loving kindness, it all arises out of seeing suffering. I mean, and that's really the key point. You know, that when we really understand that ill will, we're harming ourselves, we're needlessly creating suffering for ourselves, then one relinquishes. It doesn't even arise. So that seeing, I mean, the seeing those Four Noble Truths, seeing suffering, seeing the cause of suffering, seeing that, oh yeah, there is a cessation of suffering, you know, recognizing the path, you know, it's kind of, you think, wow, that's just boilerplate Buddhism. But it's the reality, so that when we really are able to take that aspect of the Buddha's teaching and say, yeah, the suffering, those Four Noble Truths, seeing dukkha, seeing its cause, really understanding that, there's a natural relinquishment that doesn't allow for ill will or anything. I remember, it's actually Ajahn Mahabua, is a very well-known forest monk. He just died earlier this year. He was like 97, 98. Highly respected disciple of Ajahn Mun. And I heard it on a recording of a conversation that when he came to visit the International Forest Monastery, the branch of Ajahn Chah's in Ubon. And I can't remember what the actual question was, but it struck me so strongly when Ajahn Mahabua said, for the enlightened mind, there's no choice but compassion. It's how it works. And it's how the liberated mind actually works. There isn't a choice of ill will or aversion. It's loving kindness, compassion. It's just the way it works. Because one doesn't create suffering. Okay, please explain upekkha, which is the last of Brahma-viharas, 10 perfections, 7 factors of enlightenment. Sounds important. It is. It is. If somebody has, say, rightly taken note of something that really is important. Upekkha is equanimity, but, you know, the translations always fall flat sometimes. So that quality of upekkha is like the mind that is really even, steady, equanimous, serene, clear, steady, all of those things. And to be equanimous is also sort of being right in the middle of things. It's not equanimous because of just blowing everything off and not dealing with it, or just being indifferent, so it'll go away. Actually, indifference is seen as a stain of equanimity. It's seen as a misapplication of equanimity. So that sense of equanimity, really being in the middle, but being very balanced, very clear, very steady, and unshakable. And I think that's maybe a useful word to say, oh yeah, this is that unshakable quality of being equanimous. knowing the vicissitudes and the changes and the extremes that can either take place internally or externally, but not being shaken by it. Can you please speak about the difference between clear seeing and awareness? Does one precede the other? I guess a lot of it depends on what one, how one defines each of those terms, so that awareness being more, maybe being more like the attention and alertness, and then clear seeing being a bit more encompassing in terms of a recognition of the circumstances that one's in. When the Buddha defines mindfulness, or you know, when he said, well, what is mindfulness? And then it's then there's a constellation of qualities that the that he then describes, and you know, and it encompasses and includes these qualities of clear seeing and awareness. And it's probably not necessary or maybe even useful to think in terms of differences, but sort of seeing how can those work together? How can those qualities of mind function together in the mind? Because the mind relies on these different aspects or abilities. Okay. Thank you for your talk on the hindrances. I have a friend, a beloved aversive type, who has regular angry outbursts. I chalk it up to frustration, yet find myself floundering in how to respond. Should I try to practice metta and patience? Limit my association? Any words would be appreciated. Yeah, I mean, dealing with people who have sort of outbursts of anger or really display anger is sometimes really, I say, disconcerting, difficult to deal with. And, what it oftentimes makes one want to either just shrink away or respond, with more aversion, which neither of those are particularly skillful. And sometimes it's not even good to respond, because in the heat of the moment, any kind of response will usually be, just start the ball rolling. That's where that quality of patience is helpful, in the sense that not feeling compelled to respond, and having a sense of loving kindness to the degree that one is recognizing, when somebody gets angry and it comes out, they're suffering. It's hard to be gracious when that's happening, but it is noble when one can work it up. And it is helpful to reflect on, well, what's behind that, and to be able to try to, especially if it's a friend or somebody one has to be in contact with, trying to understand, well, what's behind that? Because usually when there's, when there is anger coming out, then it's usually there's some sort of frustration, some sort of irritation that is overwhelming. And but also it is some people, and it's good not to draw close or to try to distance oneself. Even in monastic life, there's people who I know who really aversive type, and you just really don't want to spend much time around them. It's all you can do. So that there's different different ways, and there's not a nice, neat, and tidy solution. A lot of it depends on the necessity and the closeness of the person to recognize, well, what is the most skillful response. The very last question is, what is the correct motivation and expectation for meditation? I think correct motivation is always around freeing oneself from suffering. And it's coming back to those Four Noble Truths. It's so easy for it all to end up, we take it all so personally. And if one can shift that attention into suffering, cessation of suffering, and then it's not about me, it's not about the personality, then that motivation and expectation is both skillful and realistic. Mm-hmm.